I'm Peter O'Dowd, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support your NPR station at donate.npr.org/now. Here and Now helps you make sense of the world right now, the impact of the pandemic on every aspect of our lives, the transition to the Biden administration, and how that will change Washington and America and your hometown, and all the stories from around the country, the local and regional news that resonates everywhere. So make a donation today, and that investment will come right back to you. It is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. It is a historic day in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. This morning, the first publicized vaccination in the U.S. went to a nurse at Long Island Jewish Medical Center in Queens, New York. And over the course of the week, many more frontline medical workers across the country will receive the first dose of Pfizer's vaccine.
But that good news comes along with a devastating milestone. About 300,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, and that number is expected to rise. NPR science correspondent Allison Aubrey joins us with the latest. And Allison, the FDA, as we know, issued emergency authorization for this vaccine late Friday. Now it's actually being administered to some healthcare workers. We've actually been watching these trucks pull up and people getting their shots. How has this rollout gone so far?
Well, it's just starting. As you mentioned, we see the first images of healthcare workers being vaccinated today with the Pfizer vaccine, including that critical care nurse at the Long Island Jewish Medical Center you mentioned. She says she feels very hopeful today. And don't we all, right, Tanya? This event in New York was streamlined and promoted by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who says, you know, the vaccine only works if the American people take it. More than 600 sites will receive a shipment of the vaccine this week. I've spoken to physicians in charge of coordinating distributions at several large hospital systems around the country, and they're ready to go. For instance, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, they tell me they've planned to begin vaccinations on Wednesday.
They're ready to go. But, you know, we were talking a lot about this Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine requiring ultra-cold storage. Could that jeopardize its safe delivery?
You know, there has been great attention in the planning and executing of this delivery. Everything from the packaging that Pfizer is using to keep the vials cold at that minus 94 degree Fahrenheit temperature to the shipping itself, delivery of the packages. This is highly orchestrated. And, you know, lots of people working together, Operation Warp Speed, UPS, state leaders, coordinators at the various hospitals. All of the hospitals receiving shipments this week have been planning for months. They've got the freezers on hand, and they will be able to keep these vials in storage. Once the vials come out of deep freeze, they need to be used pretty quickly, within 5 days. So there are lots of logistics here. And remember, they won't have much supply to start, but that's expected, you know, the supply of the vaccine is expected to ramp up fairly quickly.
Yeah. COVID-19, as I mentioned, has killed around 300,000 Americans. That is such a grim picture. What can we expect in the coming weeks?
You know, we are averaging about 200,000 new cases a day and between 2,000 and 3,000 deaths. And the upward trend in cases, in hospitalizations, and in deaths that began before Thanksgiving is really just getting worse. I spoke to Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown University. Here she is.
Even before the Thanksgiving holiday, we were on a steep upward trajectory in terms of the number of new cases and in terms of the number of new deaths. And I realized that everybody has pandemic fatigue. We're tired of living like this. But I would also remind people that we are at basically a 9/11 every day in terms of the number of people that we're losing. And that number is going up.
You know, when we hit 3,000 deaths a day, that's about two people per minute dying from COVID-19. So this vaccine news is wonderful. But right now we need to stay vigilant with masking and social distancing, things that you have heard before. It's all critical right now.
That really brings it home. 9/11 every day.
Right.
So we know that. Yeah, absolutely. So we know healthcare workers and nursing home residents, as you said, are first in line for the vaccine. How long until it's available to all of us?
You know, the federal government has purchased about 100 million more doses of the Moderna vaccine. Moderna has already applied for emergency use authorization and an advisory committee meeting on this subject is set up for later this week, so it could be approved very soon. And the leaders of Operation Warp Speed have said 100 million Americans should be vaccinated by the end of March.
Okay. President Trump rescinded a plan to have White House staff in the first round of vaccinations. What do you make of this political gesture?
Right. So yesterday, a spokesperson for the National Security Council at the White House had said that senior officials across all three branches of government would be getting vaccinated to kind of ensure the continuity of government, right? But after that announcement, there was negative reaction on social media. People were really questioning whether this was fair, given the limited supplies to start. And then Trump tweeted last night that people in the White House would not be getting the vaccine right away, nor would he. Now, it is not clear whether he even needs the vaccine himself since he had COVID and recovered. Experts still don't know exactly how long immunity lasts.
That's NPR's science correspondent, Allison Aubrey. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you for having me.
Well, many healthcare workers are ready to go, eager to roll up their sleeves and get the new vaccine. At least a few are wary, if not deeply mistrustful, of what's inside the vial. Martha Biebinger of our home station WBUR in Massachusetts reports.
Every day, Dr. Mark Lewis and fellow anesthesiologist at Tufts Medical Center insert breathing tubes for COVID patients who need intensive care.
We are in their mouths. We are right in their face. We're literally inches away from their face.
With full protective gear, of course. But for Lewis, the vaccine offers a whole new level of safety and assurance.
I think it's a game changer, and I would compare it to getting front row seats at a Rolling Stones concert back 15 years ago. Sign me up.
At least a few physicians aren't so sure. Dr. Michelle Finkel, an OBGYN in Cambridge, supports vaccines in general.
My children are fully vaccinated. I get a flu vaccine every year.
But right now, Finkel is pregnant. Pregnant women were not enrolled in the coronavirus vaccine trials, so Finkel has a lot of questions that aren't answered.
Although I think the vaccine is likely safe and effective now, what happens if or when it crosses the placenta, and if there's any danger to the unborn fetus in utero or after birth?
Finkel says she's leaning toward getting the vaccine, but still isn't sure what she'll do. Barbara Braccio, a nurse who cares for COVID patients in Worcester, the largest city in central Massachusetts, says until a few weeks ago, she was adamant she would not get the shots.
Because I felt like it was a new vaccine. It was rushed through.
But Braccio says her resistance is crumbling during a second crushing wave of COVID patients.
I'm just tired of the fight with the COVID. I just want to see it go away, and it's not going to just go away. So the best option is the vaccine.
There are signs that a lot of nursing assistants, techs, lab workers, and cleaning staff share Braccio's initial concerns. One of the state's largest healthcare unions, 1199 SEIU, has polled members asking if they are ready to get a coronavirus vaccine. Preliminary results show about half of respondents say no. Tim Foley, the union's executive vice president, says many SEIU members are women of color who remember the Tuskegee syphilis study and other dangerous, unethical medical research.
We know there's some barriers and obstacles, and we need to make sure that we're doing all that we can now to make sure folks have the information that they need to feel comfortable taking the vaccine.
Some hospitals are reaching out to hesitant employees, especially staff of color who are asking why they should go first.
We understand how that could create concern and build on mistrust that exists. This is a new
Dr. Joseph Betancourt, the chief equity officer at Mass General, answers this way in both Spanish and English language videos.
If you are getting it first, it is because you are especially valued and it is because you are especially at risk.
Betancourt says Mass General will reinforce that message by reserving vaccination appointments every day for employees from Chelsea, Revere, and other communities with high infection rates. It's not clear how much pressure hospital employees will be under to get vaccinated. The shots will not be mandatory, and Tufts Medical Center's chief medical officer, Dr. Saul Weingart, says if staff are not ready to get the vaccine, he'll take that into account when deciding who goes first.
My hope is that we can make this as democratic as possible and as good to get as much input from individuals as possible.
But since hospitals are receiving the first doses, they may set the tone and expectations for vaccine priority groups that follow. Here's UMass Memorial's Dr. Kimberly Fisher. She ran a national coronavirus vaccine opinion study earlier this year.
Physician recommendations for a vaccine are very influential, and one of the strongest influences in a patient's decision about whether or not to be vaccinated.
So the spotlight now is on the doctors, nurses, physician assistants, and other members of the medical teams we turn to for guidance about our health. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger in Boston.
Well, even as the first shots go into arms of healthcare workers here in the U.S. and in the United Kingdom, the crisis is far from over. Britain's health secretary says London and surrounding areas will be placed under the highest level of coronavirus restrictions starting Wednesday as infections rise rapidly in the capital. Matt Hancock says that a new variant of the virus may be to blame. He says that the government must take swift action after seeing very sharp exponential rises in Greater London. World health leaders are warning that rich countries are already leaving poorer ones behind in the race to distribute a coronavirus vaccine. Here's Melinda Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, on CNN.
Everybody needs this vaccine. And if we only get it to the high-income countries, this disease is going to bounce around. We're going to see twice as many deaths, and our recovery of our economies is going to be much, much slower than if we get the vaccine out to everybody.
Well, joining us now is Thomas Boyke, director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Thomas, nurses and doctors in the United States are getting shots as we speak today. How much of a head start do rich countries have over the rest of the world?
Certainly for most countries, they're going to be months behind where we are in the United States, the UK, and European Union. The UK and the US are starting to distribute vaccines now. Canada and Europe will come next. If you're in a country like, say, South Africa, it's uncertain when you're going to get vaccines because it's really a handful of countries, 8 plus the European Union, that have bought up the earliest doses.
Well, talk more about that. One of the issues is that these richer countries are making deals directly with the vaccine developers.
That's right. So they've made advanced purchases of potential candidates. So let's take the Pfizer vaccine, the first one to be granted emergency use authorization in the UK and the US. 85% of that vaccine's capacity by the end of 2021 has already been purchased by a handful of nations. And that's going to leave other nations out. There is a multilateral initiative that's meant to buy early supplies for other countries too, but it's been starved for resources as wealthy nations have used their funds to buy their own doses first.
I wonder if you're referring to COVAX. That's the arm of the World Health Organization that is supposed to help distribute vaccines around the world. Because there was supposed to be a group that's dedicated to making sure poorer countries get this vaccine.
That's right. So COVAX is exactly what I'm referring to. It's a initiative led by the World Health Organization, but also involving some prominent global health NGOs and intermediaries, that their goal is to secure doses so that there's an equitable distribution of vaccines worldwide, driven by health needs, not just the size of a country's purse.
Hmm. The Duke Global Health Innovation Center predicts that many people in lower income countries may have to wait until 2023 or 24 to get vaccinated. What do you make of that? I mean, what does something like that mean for those countries and really for the world?
It means that the pandemic will persist longer. And that's troublesome because what people need to remember are two things in the United States. Ultimately, we need at least 70% of the population to be vaccinated with this vaccine for it to end the pandemic on its own. That's not likely to happen because, two, the United States historically is horrible at vaccinating adults. For seasonal flu annually, we generally have less than 50% of the population that's vaccinated, even smaller share of individuals in high-risk groups. This vaccine in the United States and other countries is primarily a tool to protect the most vulnerable. It means the virus will continue to circulate. And if this pandemic lasts longer because we're not breaking transmission chains, not protecting the most vulnerable in other countries, it's going to leave Americans at risk.
Well, some people are already warning that rich countries are hoarding the vaccines. We see that Canada has ordered enough shots to cover its population five times. This is something known as vaccine nationalism, right? I mean, how much of a concern is this?
It's a big concern. So vaccine nationalism is the phenomenon of countries prioritizing their own needs over other nations for vaccines. No one expects Canada and the United States to forego vaccinating high-priority populations like frontline health workers or elderly in long-term care facilities. The question is whether those nations will seek to vaccinate everyone, even low-risk adolescents, before we see any doses shared elsewhere. The problem with something like what Canada has done is vaccine manufacturing is scarce. So if Canada has used its resources to buy up capacity to manufacture vaccines, buy up early doses, it keeps COVAX and other efforts to try to supply the world from getting the vaccines they need to protect their highly vulnerable populations.
Is this something that pharmaceutical companies understand? I mean, what are they doing to address this issue?
Pharmaceutical companies do understand this. They have no interest in being in the midst of a fight over access to these vaccines. They get it. Some of your listeners may remember in the early days of HIV, there was a treatment access crisis in South Africa where the pharmaceutical companies fought the South African government over tools to try to expand their access. It ended up in a case called 39 Pharmaceutical Companies v. Nelson Mandela. They don't want to be in a situation like that. They would much rather see doses distributed globally, which is why Pfizer has reached out to COVAX. Other companies have reached out to COVAX too. What is really driving the lack of access here, frankly, is the short-sightedness of wealthy nations using all their resources to try to procure doses for themselves. Now,
another thing I'm thinking about is the logistical challenge that this distribution process will be in our own country. And then I think about what it would be like in a country that doesn't have the resources of the United States, that doesn't have the transportation infrastructure, that doesn't have cold storage in their hospitals the way that the United States does. How much of an issue will that be?
It's going to be a big issue. So there aren't many settings where you can distribute a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees centigrade globally. There's just not going to be much capacity to do that. So ideally, what you would see are wealthy nations with the capacity prioritizing their access to the vaccines that they can distribute and perhaps leaving the vaccines that other nations are able to distribute for global efforts. But that's not apparently what we will see. What we see is that wealthier nations are prioritizing their access to all vaccines, which means even the ones that are suitable for low resource settings, there may be a long delay before they become available globally.
Thomas Boyke, Director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for your insight. I do appreciate it.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Months into the pandemic, millions of Americans are still out of work and relying on federal emergency unemployment programs to stay afloat. And later this month, those programs could expire. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg reports on what that might mean for the tens of thousands of people in Maine who are already struggling to make ends meet.
For years, Heather Seavey worked in pet stores in southern Maine, offering advice about nutrition to animal owners. But when the coronavirus hit, CB says she was forced to leave her job because of her asthma and an autoimmune disorder.
Basically, getting COVID, especially with my asthma, would be, you know, a death sentence.
At first, CB says her family did okay. Her husband often worked at least 80 hours a week at his healthcare job, and her additional federal unemployment benefits of $600 per week made a big difference. But those ran out a few months ago. And CB says because of her health conditions and the need to be at home to help her 11-year-old child who has autism with distance learning, she's been unable to return to work. CB says her benefits are now less than $200 per week. So she's begun selling blood plasma to afford food and other needs.
It's just trying to juggle everything. And I just don't, you know, I'm going to go sell plasma tomorrow. Like, yeah. You know, like that's where I'm at. Like, I've got to go sell my blood again so that I can get the kids through the weekend. And it's hard. It's hard.
And it could get even harder later this month. That's when emergency federal unemployment benefits are set to run out. The expanded benefits were created as part of the federal stimulus package passed in March. But without action from Congress, the state estimates that about 35,000 Mainers could lose benefits.
Essentially, this is like throwing somebody out of an airplane with no parachute.
Andy O'Brien is a spokesperson for the Maine AFL-CIO.
People are very desperate. They're at risk of losing their homes and not knowing how they're going to feed their family, much less give their kids a Christmas.
O'Brien says Maine is heading into the winter months at a time when COVID-19 is spiking and unemployment is on the rise.
So it's getting even harder and harder to find work. And of course, Maine has a lot of seasonal, it's kind of a seasonal economy. And so in the winter months, unemployment goes up anyway. So it's a real perfect storm and, you know, something needs to be done.
Earlier this month, a bipartisan group of lawmakers announced a plan to extend the benefits as part of a larger stimulus package. But that will need to make it through Congress and be signed by the president. In the meantime, laid-off workers are trying to piece together enough to simply stay afloat.
We're struggling hard.
Jamie Hills, who lives in Burnham with her two kids, says the expanded benefits programs helped her with basic needs. But with benefits potentially running out, she's already worried about Christmas.
I'm just hoping that they're happy with just a couple of, just literally probably just a couple of small gifts because I can't afford it.
Heather Seavey, the mom we met earlier in this story, says as more days pass without new federal funding for unemployment, she feels left behind at a time that she and her family need help the most.
I was like, how does this happen that the people here in this country that have worked the hardest and the longest are the ones that are suffering so hard right now, and it's like we're invisible.
The extended unemployment benefits are set to expire this month, on the day after Christmas. For Here and Now, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
2021 will be the last season Cleveland's Major League Baseball team will be known as the Indians, a nickname Native American groups have long called racist and demeaning. The team has used the name since 1915, and an official announcement is expected sometime this week. Joining us now is the executive director of the Cleveland American Indian Movement, or AIM. Sundance is a Muskogee person who goes by one name. And Sundance, I know this is something that you and other groups have been working toward for a long time. What's your reaction to this news?
My reaction is, it's positive. As you say, we have been working for a very long time. Cleveland AIM, in particular, we have been working on this for half a century. So it's not a moment too soon. We hope that everything that happens will be positive, but we are a little dubious as well.
Well, maybe because you've been working on this issue for so long, you say decades. Why do you think it has taken this long?
Well, we are by every measure the poorest people in the country. We have no purchase power. And to be honest with you, the baseball team was masterful in weaving this narrative that basically indoctrinated fans to think that they were somehow honoring indigenous people.
But you see it just the opposite.
Certainly, we see it just the opposite. In an environment where we are the poorest people in the country, the least educated, the lowest life expectancy, the highest rate of teenage suicide, the highest rate of missing and murdered indigenous women, to have a baseball team named after you, as honor, really does us an injustice.
I understand that activists like you have been going to baseball games in Cleveland for a long time, trying to make the case to fans in person. What's that been like? I mean, have you had backlash when you try to tell people who are supporters of the team that the name should be changed?
Well, you know, the backlash from fans have been minimal. We have had many fans support us. And now that the change is apparently going to be made, I believe there are going to be many fans who support the change. At the stadium, you know, we do talk with fans who are against the name change, but their arguments are not really coherent. And especially on opening day, where many of them are inebriated, their arguments are incoherent. So for us, you know, everybody has the right to be wrong. Our issue really is with institutional racism.
How much work still needs to be done across all of sports? As you well know, the NFL team in Washington, D.C. recently retired its name and logo this year. It's now known as the Washington Football Team. So the dominoes, as it were, are starting to fall, but it's still a lot of names out there that people find offensive.
There are a lot of names out there that people find offensive at the professional level. But, you know, in Ohio, also at the secondary school level, we have a number of school systems here that have native mascots. And we are working to change that in Ohio, but that has been slow going because we have to do this on a school system by school system basis.
We've been speaking with Sundance, a Muskogee person and executive director of the Cleveland American Indian Movement. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Passions are high over the fate of more than 3 million acres of public and private land in northeast Montana. Two groups have very different views on the fate of this vast area. Allison Fox is head of an effort to turn it into the largest nature reserve in the nation, and she's a relative newcomer to the state by Montana standards. Originally from Vermont, Fox was 21 when she visited the state about 20 years ago to work at Glacier National Park for a summer, and she never looked back.
I am happiest when I'm out in nature, deep in nature. And I that summer that I visited, I met the man who is now my husband on the top of the Going to the Sun Road in Glacier National Park. And I decided at that point that I wanted to make Montana my home.
Fox is now the CEO of American Prairie Reserve, known as APR. It's backed by Silicon Valley funders who've spent millions of dollars buying up private land with the intent of creating something of an American Serengeti. This requires removing the livestock that have grazed the area for more than a century and replacing it with species like elk, antelope, prairie dog, pronghorn, and bison, species that once roamed the land. So far, APR has purchased more than 30 private properties and needs at least 50 more to make the vision complete. That includes land owned by longtime rancher Deanna Robbins, a third-generation Montanan and part of the United Property Owners of Montana.
We don't just occupy this land, and I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, is our life's work is growing food, and this is a hungry world. So our life's work is providing high-quality protein to feed the world, and we take that very seriously. We're proud of that job that we do.
Robbins feels the American Prairie Reserve's vision of an American Serengeti is an assault on her way of life. We'll hear more from her in a moment, but first my conversation with Allison Fox about why this country needs a Serengeti and why Montana is the place for it.
Starting at a global level, as you know, the planet's wild places are disappearing at an unprecedented rate. In less than half a century, we've lost 60% of wildlife populations, and temperate grasslands are actually the least protected terrestrial biome, and yet they contain incredible biodiversity. 300 species of birds, nearly 100 species of mammals, 1,600 species of plants. And the grasslands are also an important carbon sink, and they contribute to clean air and water. So it's for the preservation of this ecosystem and an intact ecosystem. That's the main why behind the work the American Prairie Reserve does.
What do you want to see these grasslands look like 10 or 20 years from now?
You're right to frame this in decades. You know, we really see this project unfolding over many decades, and in the next decade to come, and the decade after that, we will focus on continuing to acquire habitat. We'll focus on continuing to restore that habitat. We will ensure that the species that were once home there can make their homes again. You know, we have a conservation herd of bison, and that's been one of the important species restoration efforts that we've led. And then that people from really across Montana, but across the nation and the world are welcomed to this landscape. And whether they're there to bird watch or hunt or hike, we want people to experience nature at American Prairie Reserve.
This goes beyond natural conservation. You mentioned the people visiting, but it's also restoring of indigenous cultures. The Fort Belknap Indian Reservation has supported your efforts. Tell us more about this work you're doing with Native communities.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned the Ani Nakota tribes, because they're important partners for us and important constituents in the region. So we work with those two tribes in a number of ways. First, we work on local economic development opportunities. So we partner with the local economic development corporation on Fort Belknap to develop ecotourism opportunities. Thus far, that has included a naturalist guiding training program and employment of cultural interpretive guides. It also includes employment of caterers and photographers and other small business owners from reservation. Hopefully one day we would love to see the management of American Prairie facilities conducted by members of those communities. We also collaborate on species efforts. So this started with the bison. We work together to support each other in the management of our herds, and we have agreements in place to trade animals for the genetics, because our herds have different genetics. And, you know, as American Prairie's grown our herd, when we have surplus animals, giving to tribal herds across the Great Plains has been one of our priorities.
But there are some detractors who feel this might be big outside money coming in and really changing local ranchers' way of life. What do you say to that?
Yeah, we receive support from all over the country and a bit from around the world as well, and a lot from Montana. And so this is a project of global significance, and thus it has attracted the attention of people who care about grasslands and species restoration efforts and public access and recreation opportunities. And so there's room for both on the landscape, and there's room for us to work together. We do run this conservation bison herd now, and it is growing, but the majority of our properties that we own now, we are leasing the grazing on those properties out to neighbors and other community members who graze cattle on those lands. And so we're supporting agricultural economy in that way. We buy locally and hire locally, and you know, we too are part of community. We are a group of Montanans running this organization. We live in various places across the state. Many of our staff live on our properties and in neighboring communities, and we've been here for 15 years, and we care about the place and look forward to being a productive part of the community for decades to come.
That was Allison Fox, CEO of American Prairie Reserve. Rancher Deanna Robbins is now leading the effort to stop this project. She created signs that pepper the region that say, "Save the Cowboy, Stop the American Prairie Reserve." Robbins and I started off our conversation by talking about what makes the grassland so unique and perfect for cattle ranching and hunting.
It's rough country. It's arid. There isn't much for water, unless it's water that we've developed. And that's why it has become so purposeful for livestock production, is because when we developed water, it's one of the few ways that we can utilize the grass that grows here. The grass is very high in protein and minerals, so it's good for growing production livestock. And it's been considered the highest purpose of the land for over 100 years.
As I mentioned, the American Prairie Reserve has a lot of financial support from donors in Silicon Valley and New York City, places that are far from Montana. Does this also impact how you see their conservation efforts?
That does concern us, because it's basically a takeover of this area by just a few individuals with vast financial resources. So that makes it a very elite project that doesn't necessarily speak to the public like the marketing says that it will.
What would your family do, or what do you plan to do if this effort goes through? And, I mean, your land is at stake.
Well, what's at stake is it would simply become too, we raise cattle. We have a cow-calf operation where we sell a calf crop in the fall that is grown into beef production. That would be too burdensome to raise our cattle in the midst of apex predators like grizzly bears, wolves, free-roaming bison, enormous numbers of elk and deer that would all be competing for the forage, because we have no way of keeping that wildlife off of our properties. And so once they grow those numbers of all those, the predators and the competition for grass, they would eventually be on our ranch too. So it's why we're working so hard to stop them, and we believe that we will.
Do you see any way to work with them moving forward? What's non-negotiable?
No, it is non-negotiable, because as I said before, for them to succeed with their 3.5 million acre goal, our communities, our family ranches that are all in that target area, and there's a lot of them, would all be gone. And these are vibrant, healthy communities, a culture that's been here for over 100 years and really hasn't changed much. Some of my neighbors are people that my grandfather homesteaded alongside back in the early 1900s. There's a real continuity here.
What does it mean to be a cowboy or a cowgirl?
A cowboy to me is an entrepreneur, an independent spirit. We're very social, but we're also very independent in how we work. And I'm very proud to be part of that culture.
That's Deanna Robbins, a cattle rancher in Montana who opposes the American Prairie Reserve.
Late last month, Cuba's communist government began facing an unusually broad movement demanding more free speech and expression. It was led by the island's artists. The regime is refusing so far to negotiate with the movement's leaders, and it's even detained some of them. But Tim Padgett of member station WLRN in Miami reports the artists may have galvanized enough public support from ordinary Cuban citizens and the world outside Cuba to make reform possible.
These are artists protesting in front of Cuba's Ministry of Culture last month in Havana. They were denouncing the conviction of dissident rapper Denis Solis. He'd just been sentenced to 8 months in prison for contempt because he'd posted a video of Cuban police entering his home without a warrant. The demonstration, led by an artist group called the San Isidro Movement, alarmed Cuba's communist regime because it drew hundreds of supporters, including celebrities like movie star Luis Perugoria. And at first, this was the result. The artist announced Cuban officials had agreed to a dialogue about free speech and expression. But the regime has since backed away and now condemns the artists, per usual, as puppets of the U.S. and Cuban exiles in Miami. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel calls their protests an imperial show orchestrated by the Trump administration. Still, instead of being crushed, the artists' push for free expression is resonating strongly in and outside Cuba. That's prompting many to ask, could this lead to some measure of human rights reform there?
I'm cynical, but also very hopeful.
Ruben Rojas is a Miami-Dade College English professor. He heads the nonprofit Other Oceans, which builds social and cultural bridges between the U.S. and Cuba. He's in touch with many Cuban artists, including protest leader Luis Manuel Otero, who until December 3rd was detained by Cuban authorities.
They say this will not stop. This movement has been one of the biggest of my recollection right now. It's a different time in history. Cubans have internet now. They're communicating.
Rojas says one of the artist's more immediate reform demands is the repeal of Decree 349. That law was enacted 2 years ago, and it requires Cuba's artists to get official permission for just about every paint stroke, song chord, and script sentence they create. But the artist insists this is about more than tight regime control over them. Tanya Bruguera is a leading Cuban installation and performance artist and a leading artist dissident. She once dressed in public as a Santeria god known for haunting people on their birthdays if they failed to keep their promises. And she did it on the birthday of Cuba's then-dictator Fidel Castro. So when the artist's outcry began last month, Bruguera told me, Cuban police kept her from leaving her home for more than a week. And she was put under house arrest again on December 6th.
It was a sign that this campaign scares the government more than others it's faced.
Even so, Bruguera is helping lead that campaign, which is also known as N27 after their big November 27th demonstration. She believes it will last because ordinary non-artist Cubans are connecting with an artist movement in ways they hadn't before.
Thanks to social media access Cubans have today, they see this isn't just about art. It's about rights abuses they face too. They can get arrested just for complaining about long food lines.
Restraining an artist is like literally filling their tank with rocket fuel.
Award-winning Miami playwright Carmen Pelaez is a Cuban-American and a friend of Bruguera's. She feels it's not surprising Cuban artists are at the vanguard of this uncommonly potent challenge to the regime. After all, Pelaez says, Cuba's original independence hero, José Martí, was foremost a poet.
He gives the people a better story, and he shows them how to make it a reality. The Cuban artists have made the Brave space a safer space to be now.
Still, Ruben Rojas of Other Oceans says the Cuban regime is just as determined to control that Cuban story these days. Rojas points out Cuba's artists had actually experienced fewer restrictions over the past few decades. But because the regime has had to give Cubans more economic freedoms in recent years, he says it has cracked down on artistic freedom again as a way to keep Cubans from getting too bold.
Because they loosened these screws on part of their system and their rules, they had to grab control of the Cuban Revolution's narrative. And who has a narrative more than artists?
And for the moment, those Cuban artists have the stage. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
And we want to take a moment here to remember British spy novelist John le Carré, who died Saturday. He was born David Cornwell and grew up with a con man of a father who was frequently in jail. Le Carré worked as a British intelligence officer and then got into writing. His books include The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and he was famous for his ordinary spy characters who didn't resemble heroes like James Bond. Here he is on Fresh Air in 2017.
When you really have put a character together piece by piece, what makes it work is a piece of yourself. And until that happens, the character doesn't really have a being at all.
Many critics considered his work true literature, but Le Carré wouldn't let his books be considered for literary prizes. He was 89 years old. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.